Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. During the pandemic, there's been a meme about the COVID-19, as in the idea that we've gained unwanted weight due to stress eating and a loss of our routines from pandemic disruption. My guest today has a new book about weight loss, specifically that most of what is marketed to us is just that, marketing, and a setup for failure. Whether specific diets, exercise products, apps, or supplements, they all have deceiving come-ons, and we're better off sticking to the tried and true. Known as The Healthy Skeptic, which was the title of his first book, Dr. Robert Davis is the CEO and editor-in-chief of Everwell, a digital media company that produces short videos on wellness, nutrition, and fitness, which often appear in doctor's offices or waiting rooms in hospitals or other healthcare facilities. Notably, Everwell does not take advertising revenue and does not pitch any products. His latest book, which is his fourth, is called Supersized Lies: How Myths About Weight Loss Are Keeping Us Fat and the Truth About What Really Works. In a readable, easily digestible format, complete with both moving patient anecdotes and a layman's review of relevant medical literature, the book is a useful guide to avoiding the dieting traps that so many of us fall prey to. Davis offers sensible guidance on what has been shown to work and ways you can better manage your own eating and exercise to make yourself healthier. Robert Davis, author of Supersized Lies, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Robert Davis, the Healthy Skeptic, welcome to Medical Monday. I want to start with your book, Supersized Lies, and talk about some of the myths that you tackle there. And I thought there's no better one to start with than calorie counting, perhaps. You talk in the book really about people who are spending a lot of their conscious waking time, in fact, much of their lives, obsessing about their weight and about dieting. And you have many case studies in the book as well. But why, for example, do you think calorie counting is counterproductive?
Well, first of all, I like to say that calories count. So, you know, there's some people that say that calories don't matter. That's the science suggests otherwise. Calories do matter. But the problem is that counting calories often doesn't work. And there are a number of reasons for that. First of all, and the simplest is that it simply is very difficult to do precisely. So in terms of determining how many calories you're actually eating, we know we can look at the package. We can see that that big bold number at the top on a packaged food says, you know, you're getting 143 calories. The problem is that's not a precise number. Under law in the U.S., that number can be off as much as by 20% legally. And in many cases, it's an overcount. So right there, even if you have a number, it may be off. And then on top of that, we all know there are plenty of foods we eat that we don't have numbers for. If we are at restaurants and they don't have counts in the menus, or if we go to someone's house for dinner, if we go to a party, or if we cook at home, it's very hard to know how many calories we eat. Now, there are apps that can help us do that, but again, these are not necessarily that accurate or easy to use. So number one is it's hard to know for sure how many calories we're actually consuming. The other side of that equation is we don't know how many calories with great precision we're actually burning or need to burn to be in calorie deficit, to lose weight. And so there are apps, again, and things we can use, but those are at best guesstimates. So the bottom line there is just hard to do accurately to sort of get a sense of, you know, how many calories you're either consuming or need to consume or are consuming or that you're burning. So right there, that's one reason. It's just very hard to do accurately. And people try to do it and they find over time that it doesn't work. And there are other reasons as well we can talk about, but that's certainly the main one of the main reasons.
Yeah, I was surprised by that 20% figure because that's what's kind of allowed under the federal law. So I never realized there was so much leeway, so to speak, in those calorie numbers that are affixed to, you know, the foods we buy and consume. Another myth you take on, which was, I thought, particularly helpful in the book, is you have a whole chapter on what you call exercise illusions. And of course, those of us that are trying to lose weight or maintain a weight and also want to be healthy, understandably take on exercise. But some of us, I think, perhaps misguidedly try to overexercise because we become a little bit obsessed with burning a certain number of calories. And as you point out, that's hard to estimate, even in spite of some of the digital trackers that we have. What are some of those illusions about exercise that you write about in the book?
Well, let me first of all say I'm a huge proponent of exercise. My last book was all about exercise. I'm an avid exerciser myself. So everybody should exercise or move your body in whatever way you can. It's the closest thing, I believe, to a fountain of youth. That said, the number one reason that people often exercise is to lose weight. And that's a shame because of all the things exercise can do, from, you know, improving your sex life and reducing the risk of colds to reducing your risk of heart disease and cancer and everything in between, the one thing it doesn't do so well is helping people lose weight. And that's because simply that exercise does not burn a lot of calories, at least the kind of exercise most of us do, whether we go for a walk or take a yoga class. And people often find that they are not losing the weight they expected and they give up on exercise. If people do a lot of exercise, we're talking, as you're describing, going to the gym, burning huge numbers of calories, the problem is our bodies compensate. They respond over time. And that is, they ramp metabolism down. So metabolism slows down as we're burning more calories and losing weight from exercise. And appetite can increase so that we end up eating more. So in those ways, our bodies actually fight us. And so, again, exercise over time, even if you burn a lot of calories, may not be effective for weight loss.
Yeah, and we know this from studies, too, in terms of that conservation of caloric expenditure, which is detailed very beautifully in studies of the few remaining hunter-gatherer peoples left on Earth. You know, they go to great caloric expenditure to try to recruit, you know, what few calories they can from their environments. And it turns out that over time, of course, they become accustomed to this huge caloric expenditure and they wind up conserving essentially their metabolism and their energy. It's very, very interesting. And as you point out, but one of the things I learned from that work, which I think you're emphasizing here too, is that, and you said at the outset, exercise is very important for overall health. It may not be good for weight loss, but it is actually important for maintenance of weight. That's where it may be beneficial.
Absolutely. And that's an important point. So studies do show that if people want to maintain weight loss or avoid weight gain in the first place, exercise is crucial. It also can reduce visceral fat, right? That's the kind of fat that is typically found around the waist. It's associated with negative metabolic effects. And so exercise also has been shown to help reduce that kind of fat. So again, there are certainly benefits related to weight. But again, when it comes to actually losing weight, it's not such a great way to do that.
Okay, let's tackle another myth. And you mentioned pretty much all of these in the book, but we can kind of count them on our fingers. There's paleo, there's raw, there is Atkins, there is sort of the Dean Ornish method, there's caloric restriction, there's extremely low fat, which is sort of the same as the Dean Ornish. There are many others I think I'm forgetting at this point, but you're not a big fan of either these specific diets or in particular this like specific nutrient theories of how to lose weight. And I guess I'd love to give you this platform to kind of talk about what's wrong with those diets. And it's not that they're entirely wrong. I mean, they get people focused on controlling some of their behavior or their eating habits. But I think your main point is they're kind of difficult to sustain in the long run. And so ultimately, they wind up becoming a little bit self-defeating. But what are your favorite bugaboos in those worlds?
You're right. And I think for most diets, most of these diets can work in the short term, and many people find success with them in the short term. But again, with weight loss, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. So the question really is, does any diet work over time? And is it sustainable? And the answer for most of these, for most people, is no. They may work for 6 months or a year, but people find that eventually the diets stop working and they become increasingly difficult for people to sustain, because they require great sacrifices. They require cutting out some food or some category of foods, which for most of us can become very difficult, because if they're foods we really enjoy eating and we're told never to eat those, it's almost, in many cases, our brains make us crave those foods even more. So it can be very, very difficult to sustain these diets. Often, in many cases, I believe these diets, the theories behind them are oversimplified. They boil weight loss down to a single food or categories of. They identify specific villains that are allegedly responsible solely for weight or primarily for weight gain. And we know about weight management, it's far more complex. It involves certainly the foods we eat, but it involves the totality of our diets. It involves biology, it involves environment. There are a number of factors. And when a diet simply focuses on one category of food and says, just cut out this food and you'll lose weight, again, it's an oversimplification of reality. And that's another reason why, in the long run, many of these diets fail.
Okay, there's one more I think I want to tackle, which is this concept of timing. And so there's lots of new information about sort of what to eat when and about periodic fasting and about, you know, a limited caloric window, so to speak, where you only eat during certain hours of the day. And again, there's some evidence for this, but it's not great. And you're not maybe a huge fan of this either, maybe for some of the similar reasons. Or what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so let's take intermittent fasting, for example. That's very, very popular. I know many people who do it, who swear by it. And again, as I say with the other diets, I'm not saying people shouldn't do these diets. If they work for them, great. But here's the problem. If you look at the science for intermittent fasting, what it shows is that it can lead to weight loss, but not necessarily more weight than a conventional calorie-restricted diet. So there's nothing magical about it. It's not as though it's going to just try it and it's going to work magically and melt away pounds. And there are some caveats. One caveat is that some research suggests that an intermittent fasting diet may result in more muscle loss than a traditional or conventional calorie-restricted diet. That's a bad thing, because when we lose weight, we want to lose fat, not muscle. So that can be a downside. So the problem is, with any of these diets, people may go in with inflated expectations. They say the diet worked for their friends. They saw on social media it works great. It's some kind of solution. And they try it. They find it doesn't work. And then they're disappointed, not only in the diet, but they're disappointed in themselves. They feel that they failed. They see that it worked for other people. It didn't work for them. And that's a big problem, because I saw from writing the book, and I've known this all along, but it was just really brought home to me in writing the book, the damage that these diets can do when people feel that they're failures, when they feel a sense of that somehow they did something wrong, that they didn't succeed in the diet, when in fact it was the diet's fault. So I just say to anybody going into any kind of diet, whether it's intermittent fasting or anything else, go in with realistic expectations. And if the diet doesn't work, don't blame yourself, because the problem is due to the diet, not to you.
Okay, you're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is Dr. Robert Davis. He is the CEO of Everwell, which is a digital media company that produces content for doctors' offices and health groups, usually on topics like wellness, nutrition, and fitness. He's also author of the brand new book, Supersize Lies, How Myths About Weight Loss Are Keeping Us Fat and the Truth About What Really Works. And we're talking about various notions of weight loss and how people take on certain diets. And my guest, Robert Davis, is very good at debunking these myths. He's also known as the Healthy Skeptic. That was the title of his first book. And Robert, I wanted to ask you about another topic that's sensitive for some people. The healthcare in general has come to rely on a measurement called the body mass index. And this is sort of a numeric value that's created by sort of dividing somebody's, is it their height by their weight or the other way? I always forget. But you point out what are some of the discrepancies with BMI and why it's certainly not the best, perhaps, measurement for it may be better slightly than just the weight alone, but it is problematic nonetheless. Tell us about BMI, body mass index.
Yeah, so body mass index, as we know, is the standard that's used sort of by a number of people, not only, you know, used in studies to talk about weight, but it's used in the clinical setting, used if you go to the gym sometimes. Wherever you go, you see this. And so the problem is it's just an overly simplistic measurement, because it, as you say, involves only two things, your height and weight. And so the problem is, and what studies show, is that it can, in some cases, label people as obese who are actually, who fall in that category because they have a lot of muscle. And likewise, it can label people as, quote, normal, who actually have a lot of internal fat, who are, as you might say, skinny fat. And so it can be that people are metabolically unhealthy and labeled as obese or as labeled as normal. And you can have people that the opposite can be true as well. So the problem is that it's not a great indicator. Now, the question is, what's the alternative? And that's why it keeps being used, because there's not an obvious candidate to replace it. So we have, for example, some people will suggest waist circumference. And that's the idea that if you're a man and your waist is over 40 inches and you're a non-pregnant woman and it's over 35, that's an indicator of an increased risk of poor metabolic health. That may be a better indicator, although there's some question around these cutoffs, whether they apply to all ethnic and racial groups. And then the best indicators are things, measures of body fatness, such as underwater weighing, DEXA scans. But the limitation there is these aren't widely available. They can be expensive, so they're not necessarily easy to do. So I think BMI has continued to be the standard just because there's not a great alternative that's simple and inexpensive. But I think we certainly need something to give us a better indicator of who needs to be more concerned about their weight and who may not need to be as concerned.
So in the book, you have a very short stint in that chapter about what you call the unreal ideal as far as the ideal body weight, about penny scales, which I thought was a really nice little tribute to the penny scale industry and how it kind of went the way of the horse and buggy. But I had no idea that in the 1930s, penny scales were bringing in 10 billion pennies annually, like $100 million, which in 1930s money is a lot of money we're talking about. And these were the scales that you'd see kind of all over everywhere in like dry goods merchants or county fairs or things, and they would give you fortunes and things like that. And so I guess there are, of course, people who collect these since they're not really made anymore. But I guess getting your weight done was more of a novelty back then than it is now, with the bathroom scale kind of made those obsolete.
Right. And people would go to these, and it was a fun thing to do. Imagine that, a fun thing to step on a scale. But that's the way that the manufacturer of these scales made them fun, where they'd give you, you'd get cards of that showing pictures of movie stars that you could collect. And some of them would actually announce your weight out loud. Imagine that in a public place, how that would be greeted with horror today. But yes, they were quite a phenomenon until the bathroom scale came along and replaced them. But that was a time when the only way to know your weight was going to the doctor's office or using these penny scales. But as I point out in the book, the problem is that back then, we were no more sophisticated now than we were back then as to how to interpret those numbers. So that back then, there were these charts that were used to show whether you were, quote, normal or not. And today, the sort of successor to that is the BMI. As we just discussed, though, that's not necessarily a great indicator of whether you should be unhappy or happy with the weight you're at. So my point in talking about penny scales was the technology has evolved enormously, but our ability to interpret the number has not.
Okay, so lest you think that my guest today, Robert Davis, is only a skeptic, and he spends, you know, a good portion of the book debunking a lot of this mythology, he does, you're probably saying, well, what works? You know, what should I be doing if you know, using one of these brand name diets is not the way to go, if obsessing about my body mass index or something, or if exercise isn't the key to losing weight, although, as we both want to point out, exercise is a key to a healthy lifestyle, that's very important. Robert, what does work? And you have several suggestions. I don't think we can go into all of them, but what are your, say, top three in terms of what works for either controlled weight loss, maintained weight loss, or, you know, healthier living in general?
Well, one certainly is to focus on the overall quality of your diet rather than fixating on particular categories of foods. But what does that mean? Well, it means eating a whole foods diet, a mostly plant diet that includes fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, beans, lean meats, dairy, if you include dairy, and minimizing, and notice I'm not saying never eat these foods, but trying to minimize highly processed foods, things like chips, candy, sweets, soda, fries, things like that. Now, that's the same diet you might notice that's recommended for optimal health. And it turns out that not only is that kind of diet good for our health, it's also good for long-term weight control. And studies show this, and it could be because it has lower energy density, meaning that we get fewer calories per bite. It could be that it's more likely to fill us up than highly processed foods that leave us hungry and wanting to eat more. There are a number of theories as to why, but that's the kind of diet that's going to be most beneficial long-term for successful weight control. We talked about exercise. That's certainly crucial for the reasons we said in terms of maintaining weight loss. And I think another one I would just throw in there is keeping a food diary. This is something that many people recommend, and studies show it actually works because, you know, we often eat in ways we're not aware of. It may be that when we're stressed, we eat more, or when we're a group of people, we eat differently than when we eat at home, or when we're working late at night, we eat differently, and we may be just completely unaware. And the point of keeping a food diary is that you record not only what and how much you're eating, but, you know, where you're eating it, who you're eating with, how you feel when you're eating, while you're eating, and after you're eating. And if you have that information, you can look at the data, have better data about your own eating patterns, and make changes accordingly. So I think greater awareness of your eating habits, your eating patterns, is crucial so that you can focus on that and figure out where to make changes and figure out where you're making improvements.
Yeah, I want to emphasize that too, because I have definitely given out the recommendation to folks to keep a food journal, but I actually had never done it this extensively, which I like, which is the whole sense of how you feel when you ate a certain food, because that's sort of a trick from mindfulness and meditation, is the idea that you actually think through the emotion, because so much of the eating we do and the overeating we do in this country is emotional. And then, as you point out, what activities were you doing at the same time? Were you watching TV? Were you driving? Were you at work? And then what that journaling allows you to do is set up some sort of a knowledge or give you some insight into the patterns of where you might be overeating or eating non-nutritively. And so I think that that's some really wise advice. One other subheading here is you talk about strategic planning. And of course, that's sort of a buzzword in the business world. But I was wondering if you could tell us what you mean by strategic planning with regard to thinking about how you eat or when or that kind of thing.
Sure. By strategic planning, I mean planning ahead for the inevitable challenges that come with weight management. No matter how diligent someone is, we all know that work, family, everyday life are going to get in the way and sometimes cause disruptions and difficulties. So the idea of strategic planning is to anticipate those things, to anticipate the things that may derail you and be prepared with actions that almost are automatic. So that it becomes what a sort of go-to if you encounter these things. So for example, if you know that you are inclined to emotional eating, the idea is to be ready with a plan and to say, okay, if I get hungry, I stop and think on a scale of 1 to 10, am I really hungry? And if so, you eat a healthful snack. But if not, are you hungry because you're bored? Are you hungry because you're lonely? Are you hungry because you're upset? Then to have a plan in place. And that is, I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to call a friend. I'm going to listen to music. That's just one example. If you tend to be tempted when you go to a store and you're in the checkout line by the candies and all the junk food that's there, you have a plan in place that you're going to check your email, for example, so that these become automatic responses so that instead of relying on willpower, you have these go-to responses to help deal with these inevitable challenges that will arise. And so that way you're able better able to stay on track and to keep going. And again, we all have to go easy on ourselves. Sometimes we're going to fall off the wagon, but people have to understand that's going to happen. And they have to just be prepared with these kinds of built-in responses to help them keep going.
I love that. I have to say the strategic planning, I think, is a brilliant idea for, avoiding those tricky situations. Okay, you're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Robert Davis. He is known as the Healthy Skeptic. He's the CEO and editor-in-chief of Everwell, which we're going to talk about in a second. He's also the author of the new book, Supersized Lies, How Myths About Weight Loss Are Keeping Us Fat, and The Truth About What Really Works, which we just talked about. And Robert, I want to ask you about Everwell. Tell us what Everwell is and what it does.
Everwell creates health-related video content on subjects including weight loss, as we're talking about today, diet, nutrition, fitness, medication compliance, a whole host of wellness topics. We create these short videos and we air them in physicians' offices and medical settings. And so the idea is to help people focus on their health when they're in a place and maybe a captive audience, sitting in the doctor's office, to give people information, to help give them practical tips and information, science-based information to help them make better decisions about their own health. It's something I've had a passion for my entire adult life, and that is providing information to people to allow them to lead better lives. And this is just one other way that I'm able to do it, and hopefully it's helpful to people.
And I wanted to ask about one of your previous books, which the title of which was so intriguing, Coffee is Good for You. can you share that, the premise of that with us?
Sure. And actually, if you look at the title, it's Coffee is Bad, Crossed Out, and Good Written In for You. And the idea of that book, and coffee is just one of, I think, about 65 subjects I cover. And I chose coffee is because that's sort of the quintessential example of something we hear. It's good for you. No, it's bad for you. No, it's good for you. And so the idea was to talk about a number of different topics around nutrition, whether it's red meat, red wine, you name it, and to sort of break down the science and say, okay, here's what we know, here's what we don't know. And I'm going to sort of give you the scoop on that claim. How believable is that claim? Is it true? Is it false? Is it somewhere in between? So the idea was to talk about a number of these things we often hear about nutrition and to help readers make more informed decisions about how believable these claims are based on the science.
Okay, well, yeah, I love that. And of course, anytime we talk about coffee, my ears always prick up a little bit. All right, I want to come back to the current book, Supersized Lies. Near the end of the book, you have in the kind of the what works section, you say that in spite of everyone's best intentions and possibly eating more nutritively, having a healthier overall lifestyle, exercising regularly, going to more plant-forward diet, and not overeating, that in spite of that, some people still struggle with their weight or obesity. And you're quite open about that and honest. So you have a little heading called Calling in the Cavalry. And you talk about intensive behavioral therapy, which was news to me. I didn't actually realize that the United States Preventive Services Task Force had actually graded this and found it to be an intervention that had a significant evidence in favor of it. Can you talk a little bit about that and then possibly criteria for, bariatric surgery and those types of interventions?
Right. So intensive behavioral therapy is simply getting help from a professional. And that professional can be a psychologist. It can be another kind of counselor. It can be a physician. It can be a nurse practitioner, any number of health professionals that essentially, in a way, serve as a coach to help you work through efforts around weight control. And so, but this includes not only what you eat and your diet and your exercise, but also your mindset. Because as one person said to me, who I was interviewing for this book, successful weight control is not just about your diet. It's also about your mindset. And it's about dealing with what's in your head and also how you cope with a lot of the challenges that come around weight control, whether it's emotional eating, whether it's too little time, whether it's family requirements, whatever the case may be. And so behavioral therapy deals with weight management in a comprehensive way to allow you to incorporate all of these different aspects. And so that's why I believe that this approach is successful for many people and is an important component. And you can get this not only working with health professional, there are certain commercial programs such as Noom. And again, I don't get money from them. I'm not endorsing them necessarily, but programs like Noom that incorporate behavioral therapy into the program. So that can be an important component of successful weight management is some form of behavioral therapy.
Yeah. And so you talk a little bit about weight loss surgery, also known as bariatric surgery, that it's another effective option for people with what's considered morbid obesity, which we classify as a body mass index of usually over 40 or over 35 with obesity-related medical conditions. And I don't want to get into the specific types of surgery, but you conclude, I think, or is it safe to say, what's your opinion on the evidence about these forms of weight loss surgery that are available to us nowadays?
I think the evidence is good that these kinds of interventions can be quite successful for the right candidates. And as you say, they're intended for people who have a BMI who are considered obese on the BMI scale. Again, we say it's not a perfect scale, but generally that's a scale that's used here for people who either are obese or considered overweight on the scale, but also have at least one condition such as diabetes. And what the studies show is that they can greatly improve the metabolic effects that are associated with obesity. They can obviously result in large amounts of weight loss, larger than typically lifestyle interventions. Now, that said, there are potentially significant risks. And so people have to, as there are with any kind of surgery, and so people have to carefully weigh the risks of the surgery with a healthcare provider against the risks of continuing to carry excess weight. And so that's going to vary from person to person as to where you come down on that, on how to weigh that, so to speak. But I think it's that option is certainly there, and it has been. Many people have found it successful. One thing I will say is sometimes people look to surgery and say, well, I don't want to do that. That's a cop-out. And it is just the opposite. It's not a cop-out at all. First of all, surgery is not easy. You're going through fairly major surgery, number one. And number two, it doesn't mean that you can just then eat whatever you want. Even if you have surgery, you still need to focus on the same things that you would if you weren't having surgery. That is to focus on the composition of your diet and to focus on moving your body over the long term. So in no way is a cop-out. And it's unfortunate when people shy away from surgery because they see it as some kind of cop-out.
Yeah, and I agree with your assessment. Also, like to emphasize, it too is a lifetime commitment. So even though some people would see surgery as sort of a silver bullet solution, it requires a lifetime commitment because there are many post-operative forms of aftercare that patients must engage in, including certain vitamin therapies, and of course making sure that they exercise and do those similar types of things to maintain their weight that anyone should do. And so it is not a be-all and end-all solution. Well, the name of the book is Supersize Lies by my guest today, Dr. Robert Davis, who is also known as the Healthy Skeptic. He's also the CEO of Everwell, a digital media company that produces short videos on wellness, nutrition, and fitness. Robert Davis, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. It's been a great pleasure.
The name of the book is Supersize Lies: How Myths About Weight Loss Are Keeping Us Fat and the Truth About What Really Works. And it's by my guest today, Robert Davis, also known as the Healthy Skeptic. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and do please stay safe out there.